Paul Marie, welcome to this evening's session with Miss Ruth Benson, a vascular surgeon based in Christchurch, having trained in the UK. She runs the fourth year specialist surgical module for vascular and cardiothoracic surgery, dermatology, and plastics. She has managed to fit in a PhD while also being a mum and helping us with talks for our surgical papers. Thank you very much for your time this evening. And we are also joined by David Short, one of the conveners of the Gen 727 Surgical Specialties paper, and he works as a GP and a rural hospital medicine specialist in the South Island. Our evening is supported by the Section of Rural Health Department of General Practice at the University of Otago and is endorsed for 1 hour of CME by the Royal New Zealand College of General Practitioners. We have decided to focus initially on the limbs, and if time allows, we may move on to some of more of the central aorta and dissection. But if we run out of time, then we'll just defer this to a further session. So without further ado, I'll hand over to Ruth.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you, Lucinda and David, for getting all the tech sorted. So I've been invited to try and focus on a few things. They've asked me to make it case-based, which I have done as much as possible. The first one is a 53-year-old man. He's come in with pain in his foot and subjective fevers. So he's describing things like Rigors, but he doesn't have a thermometer at home, so he can't really tell you, for a couple of days, and he's just started vomiting. He doesn't think there's anything wrong with him. He's never been diagnosed anything in the past. He's never really gone to the doctor. He's a builder. His second toe's been looking off for a week after he stubbed it, and he's been working throughout in steel toe caps. It's not been particularly painful. So I suppose, what does this tend to, are there any alarm bells ringing, and how would you guys tend to approach it where you are? So that's what his second toe looks like. So on the left, if I looked at that picture, there's an open wound and probably some moth-eaten bones sticking out. So almost a compound fracture of his second toe, which you would expect to be excruciating. So the fact that it hasn't been should raise spidey senses. And if you look at the X-ray, that's an example of what the X-ray might look like. So there is definitely a pathological fracture underneath it. That's if you've got access to urgent X-rays out of hours, radiolucency at the distal end of the bone. Because he's described subjective rigors and he's got evidence of infection, I appreciate it doesn't meet the true definition of sepsis because you don't have any bloods or a second marker. But this is probably a time to consider treating sepsis. And one of the reasons to think about that is because he started to vomit. So if he's got a relatively insensate foot and he's got bilateral stocking style neuropathy, and then diabetes undetected is there, and therefore vomiting suggests that he might be at risk of DKA, but also as a systemic sign of being much more unwell than he thinks he is. So if taking bloods wherever you might be, would you routinely include BMs? Or would you do a finger prick blood glucose? And then antibiotics early based on local protocol. So depending where you are, it might be an IM dose, an intravenous dose. Augmentin is often a nice broad spectrum one, but some places, because the most common skin commensal and diabetic foot organism is sensitive to flucloxacillin, often flucloxacillin is first line. Not many places here combine it with metronidazole, but I'm happy to be proven wrong. And the same with resuscitation, if indicated. If he's been vomiting and he's got high BMs, chances are he's grossly dehydrated. And then this is the kind of thing we would be really happy with, an early phone call and a direct transfer, either to vascular or orthopedics. And that often depends on whether or not there's a palpable pedal pulse. And frankly, the attitude of the local surgeons. So I think we have mostly moved into the frame of mind that if we think it's diabetic foot sepsis, we manage it so frequently, we'd much rather that we just see it. And if there's a pulse in the foot, fantastic. We don't need to do any other intervention except for manage the sepsis and try and get a healed wound. But it's got to be early because often by the time a very specific subtype of patient presents, they're quite far on down the line. And the trouble that we have, and this is a broad generalization, is that people tend not to like feet, especially really unappealing, very smelly ones. And these are the kinds of examples of things that might arrive with you and might look fairly innocuous, but are already in the throes of causing subcutaneous pus and putting the patient at risk of limb loss. So things like the one in the top middle with those areas which give you the impression that there is bogginess and spreading cellulitis. The plantar aspect of the foot is a very common site for pus to develop because it develops in the extensor tendons of the feet and it tracks up them. So it's quite deep. But bogginess and pain, unexpected for what you see, is a sign that there's pus in the foot. And the same with that picture on the far right. The toes might look like they're all right, but actually that third toe is dusky and the top of the foot is very red and probably boggy with a sign of a foot that's probably got chronic diabetic changes. It's dry, it's cracked. And the other thing that often happens is we get a phone call about something like this. So someone comes in and they're a bit unwell, but the eschar on the heel is dry. This is a really common place because it's a pressure point. And we say, how are they doing? Does it look like there's any pus underneath? And quite rightly, the clinician says, I don't think so. I think it's just dry eschar at the moment. We'll keep them overnight because you've called us at 9 o'clock at night, or maybe even 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and the transport issues can't be resolved in good time, or it involves calling a plane, or the weather is bad, which is something that we experience. But the problem is that by the time you get to tomorrow morning, it has often developed into this. And what you have is the original dry eschar, and then you have what is easy for me to say that I can see that there is now pus under there extending up towards the toes with blistering as well. And once you get to this stage without prompt drainage of that pus, they're at real risk of losing their leg. Early X-rays are the best way to rule things out, and this might be what the X-ray of that second foot 12 hours later looks like, with subcutaneous emphysema representing, for example, a gas type infection. And at that stage, you really are looking at limb threatening, but eventually actually life threatening. That is now rapidly spreading. It will rapidly spread up the extensor tendons, around the back of the medial malleolus, and straight up into the calf. Another quite innocuous looking wound in between the toes, and in diabetics, looking in between the toes is really vital and often missed. And it looks a bit innocuous, but that blistering is often the key. And that necrotic patch in between. And if you look at the X-ray for that, what you might start seeing again is that small evidence of more localized but still present subcutaneous emphysema. And again, that is a sign that there is subcutaneous pus in there that needs urgent debridement, even just making a cut in the skin to let that pus drain. So that's the
Okay.
diagnosis of sepsis. Yep.
You mentioned going back to that eschar one. Is there a way for us to tell whether it's just dry eschar versus underlying pus? Is it just purely the clinical presentation, or is there something else in terms of some tricks for looking at it?
So you would definitely expect that if they'd moved into subcutaneous pus, their inflammatory markers would be unusually high. But then if you look at the difference between here, what you get the impression of is that there's bogginess. So the word is that we use is bogginess, and it's when you're feeling, if you felt over that heel there, it would probably feel very similar to you feeling your own foot. If you felt over the skin here, it would feel like a cushion. It would feel like you were pushing on something liquid. And it will be unusual. So it's something that you feel once, and I don't think you would forget. And it's also, even in those with diabetic foot sepsis, often exquisitely tender.
Okay.
They're very painful, and it feels like you're pressing on fluid. If you are in a position where you can, then you can do something as simple as popping the largest needle you have into that and trying to aspirate. Because patients tolerate it as well as you can expect, but it's no better or worse than getting local anaesthetic, which is awful. And that's often a really, you will pop that in there, and if you just push the needle in gently while aspirating and there's pus in there, it will be florid and it will come out. That can be a very nice test.
And you mentioned early in terms of communicating with you. Can you be a bit more specific about early and what time frames we have and when we should refer this to you?
As soon as someone demonstrates signs of systemic unwellness, that's probably the time to call. So if someone comes in with that and it's been there for a week and they're really well in themselves, and there's no temperature, and they're eating and drinking nicely, and you can do a bedside blood glucose, and it's, you know, within what is normal, and I'm going to say here what's normal for them, because patients vary, then I'm going to say probably all right, because personally, we don't mind taking the phone call. We never mind taking the phone call. For something like this, and the case that I presented, they've been vomiting, they've got subjective signs and, you know, describing rigors, they're systemically well, and that becomes a clinical emergency.
Okay.
Because things happen very quickly.
Great. Okay. No other questions there, Ruth.
Lovely. Okay, so we've got the next case. I've made this quite classic, and I'm conscientious that this is also a bloke, whereas I'd like to maintain that it does happen in ladies as well, and maybe isn't recognised as quickly. But an 85-year-old man presents to the emergency department or GP practice with an acutely pale, pulseless, very painful left leg. His GCS is 15 out of 15. He's maintaining his own airway. His blood pressure is 156 over 87. And you've met him before. He's not normally hypertensive. But what his ECG has diagnosed, and it's already been clinically diagnosed, is a new diagnosis of atrial fibrillation. Unknown whether or not that's due to an acute myocardial infarction or what. But he does have a background of alcohol excess. But he's a non-smoker. And he lives independently. And he lives in his own home. He does everything that he wants. He's never been limited in anything that he does. And you examine him. And on the right leg, he's got a full complement of pulses from the groin all the way down to the two pulses in his feet. But on the left, he's only got a femoral pulse. And he's got no sensation. He's numb from mid-calf. He's got no movement in the forefoot or in his toes. And his movement at the ankle is reduced. It's there, but it's definitely reduced. And it's mainly reduced because he's very sore in his foot. But his calf is soft. It's a bit sore in the anterior compartment, but it's soft and it's not firm. So this is an example of what it might look like. And I show this to my med students, and it's cheating a bit, but hopefully you guys know a bit more. Sometimes it's actually quite difficult to tell which leg is abnormal. So you'll have to believe me in this case when I say that it's the left one that is abnormal. And you can see that it's quite swollen. And it is discoloured. So it is not beyond belief that patients like this are sent for deep vein thrombosis scans in the first instance. But for the acute limb ischemia, we're mainly focusing on the six. And I often only remember five, and then I have to write it down. Pain, pallor, perishingly cold, pulselessness, paresthesia, and paralysis. Paresthesia and paralysis are in green because they're quite late signs. And the problem with being quite late is that they're much more irreversible even after getting the blood supply back. The reason that we rush it is because skin can last for 48 hours and it can still regenerate. Even if we remove dead skin, it can re-epithelialize with or without a skin graft. But permanent muscle damage starts to come into play at about 6 hours. We recognize this during long operations, long bypasses, long aneurysm repairs, but nerve damage happens very quickly. And nerve damage also indicates severity. And the nerve damage is tricky because if it is going to come back, it takes a long time. And that's even though we get the blood supply better, if we've had a delayed presentation, you can still get permanent paralysis. So when they come into us or when we speak to somebody by phone, we try and put them into a Rutherford classification, and that helps us get an idea of whether or not, one, we can salvage this leg and how urgent it is to get down and whether they can come down in an ambulance or it's got to be a plane or it's got to go somewhere else because the weather's bad. So if it's viable, then there's not really much neurology, so they can move it. It might be a bit weak. You can hear a signal at the ankle with your Doppler if you've got one. If it's threatened, they start getting numbness, and it tends to start on the top of the foot, and the calf can start getting tense and you stop being able to hear a Doppler in the arteries. And what we don't want to see is Rutherford 3, where we believe the limb or at least the toes or the foot is lost. And that's when they've got no feeling, often from the mid-calf down, are completely paralyzed, no movement at the ankle in the toes, and they've got nothing on the veins and they've got nothing in the arteries either. And if you are in ED, Great, and we're looking at full blood count. You want baseline clotting as well, and a group and hold because these patients are probably going to need surgery. What is tricky about being in a different hospital is that the group and holds don't last. So often it's not worth doing a group and save if you're going to transfer the patient out. An ECG is absolute baseline. One for a new diagnosis of an MI and a new AF, but also left ventricular hypertrophy, which in the case of alcohol excess, if you've got cardiomyopathy, in this case, for example, is often the reason that you get the clot forming in the first place. And you're going to check cardiac enzymes. And for this, we're looking at creatine kinase as well. So your CK to look if there's an acute cardiac ischemia. And then on top of that, we're looking at the other CK, the creatine kinase, which is produced when the muscle, high volume of muscle breaks down in your calf, for example. An early clue of that is if you catheterize them. And we talk about seeing coke-colored urine, which is the myoglobinuremia in the urine. That's a terrible prognostic sign for your kidney function. If you've got access to one, the CT arteriogram is diagnostic. And if you have that diagnosis, or even if you don't, we're looking at analgesia. It does not mask signs, clinical signs, IV heparin. So if you're going to transfer a patient, often we will ask for a bolus at least. That can certainly help. Down in Canterbury and the South Island, we've got our healthcare pathways, which have got a weight-based heparin dosage chart. And I do think that is something on healthcare pathways that exists around New Zealand. If not, the centre that you refer them to can give you the appropriate adjusted dose as a single shot. Our ambulances coming from the West Coast, for example, can't always run the heparin infusion. So we just have to accept that they get a single shot and nothing else until they get to us. A urinary catheter is very helpful for that myoglobin breakdown and monitoring of urine output as well. IV access and fluids, because we'd want them to be fasted, but also hydrated to support the kidneys.
Sorry to interrupt you. Just a question from the floor. Would you ever thrombolize a patient like this?
No.
There's no possibility of immediate surgical referral?
Thrombolysis, it takes a long time. So if you had capacity and we had nothing else, and it was a graft, for example, and all the runoff, or it was a thrombosed popliteal aneurysm, then you're absolutely right. Thrombolysis might be considered to get the runoff going. And that kind of depends on the burden of the clots. And I'm going to say this, which means if all the crural arteries are filled with clots and you can't get them to us and they're a candidate, well, we'll talk about the pros and cons and why not. But if it's just an acute, what often happens in atrial fibrillation is a clot fragment dislodges. And the most common place for it to lodge is in the common femoral artery at the femoral bifurcation. And there's no, like, the lysis catheters are long, and we're talking about a clot that is maybe 2 centimeters long. So it's probably not appropriate. But yes, in some situations, we might consider it.
And what about intravenous thrombolysis? So not through a catheter, because I think you're talking about something just more technical.
I am, yes. So I think you're talking about kind of just systemic thrombolysis.
Yeah.
I have no available evidence that that is safe or effective or more effective than intravenous heparin. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So the evidence suggests that in some cases of acute limb ischemia, my apologies, localized thrombolysis can be effective, but systemic thrombolysis, I have no evidence in the past 10, 15 years that that is a safe or effective measure for it versus the risk of bleeding. I'm going to have to go and look that. Enjoy that. I might look it up. So the two main pathologies behind acute limb ischemia is either thrombosis in situ, so essentially a heart attack of the leg. So the patient has a background of peripheral arterial disease and they have a plaque sitting in the common femoral artery or the superficial femoral artery somewhere. And that plaque, for some reason, becomes unstable and it ruptures and you get that thrombosis in situ. And just like a heart attack and a ruptured plaque in the coronary circulation, it is acute, but they might have a pre-existing history of arterial disease like claudication. And then almost on par with that is embolic disease. For us, the most common cause of that is atrial fibrillation. either previously unknown or in patients with atrial fibrillation who've stopped their warfarin for medical investigation or for surgery, is sadly really common. Or in younger patients, bacterial endocarditis, which is why you might find that any patient who comes in with acute limb ischemia will have a sample of their clot sent off for microbiology to rule out endocarditis, and also for histology. And that just definitely rules out a myxoma, which is incredibly uncommon. And I'm not sure I've ever seen it come back positively. And then there are other slightly less common cases for graft thrombosis, but that will be in a patient who's got an arterial graft. So it'll be a little bit more obvious as to what's going on there. What are the differences between the two? It doesn't always really matter. The main thing is recognizing it and getting them somewhere that it can be treated. But if you've got an embolic occlusion, it's sudden. There's no history of peripheral arterial disease, like in this guy. The opposite limb will be beautifully normal, and symmetry is your friend. So if you can't feel pulses in one foot, you're always going to compare them to the other. And about 80% will have atrial fibrillation, especially if their DOAC's been stopped recently. 10% will be after an MI with akinesis of the wall and clot formation. And about 10% will be an aneurysm. What do I mean by that? Either a popliteal aneurysm or rarely an aortic aneurysm. But for someone where it's plaque thrombosis, so that acute heart attack, but in the leg, it will be sudden, but it might be slightly less acute. And they might well already have a history of claudication or a really strong cardiovascular history. And that examination in the other leg will probably be abnormal. So they might not have any pulses in the feet. Now that can be a bit trickier. So are there any questions about that?
I always have questions. Yeah. So Ruth, you know, I don't think it's always that easy to feel pulses. Yeah. Mm. And so, I mean, like sometimes I find trying to feel the popliteal and the posterior tibial absolutely a nightmare. So how hard do you have to try and persevere? Say, I mean, most of us probably have a Doppler, lots of people have ultrasound, you know, there's different tools, but for some people they won't have any of that. So, I mean, if you've got a classic clear cut, fine, no probs really, refer. But how hard do you need to try and palpate these pulses, and do you have any tricks around any of that?
Yeah, so the popliteal pulse, you've always got to press harder than you think. And what I've started doing with my medical students is often examining them on the patient and then doing it on them as well. And the problem with our patients is a lot of them are a bit older and they've got osteoarthritis of the knee, or they've had total knee replacements, for example. So the fascia is tough and it's actually quite sore, even if they've got good popliteal pulses. So the tips of the popliteal are to press as hard as you can, and then also to let the artery rest for at least 3 or 4 seconds, because I think, for me anyway, the popliteal artery always goes into a bit of a spasm when I try and feel it. So I press and then I rest for 3 or 4 seconds and I just wait. And then often the pulse comes back to me. But a lot of it is practice and just always reminding ourselves that you can only feel a pulse because you are pushing the artery against the bone. So sometimes we're examining the popliteal pulse too high in the popliteal fossa. You need to be pushing it back against the tibia. And for the feet, it's the same thing. And I say this as somebody who has lots of practice in it and who is missing vital clinical skills in many other areas, because I just don't do it that often. But I think the main thing to say is that if there is a clinical suspicion and the legs are not symmetrical, the risk is, the implication of delayed transfer and recognition is so high. We're talking limb loss, complete loss of independence. The chance of an 85-year-old getting onto a baloney prosthesis is less than 50%. So we're looking at full-time care, moving out of home, full-time assistance, wheelchair bound, that the phone call is appreciated. I suppose if anything that I can get from this is that we appreciate the phone calls. We can talk through it. But I know what you mean about the popliteal pulse. And if you can feel it, it's probably aneurysmal, right? Would I use Clexen if IV heparin is not available? Absolutely. That would be something that you would discuss with the clinician that you're sending them to. But yes, if I have an acute limb thrombosis like this and they're on IV heparin, I will operate on them while they're on IV heparin. So if your options are treatment dose Clexen, then you discuss it with whoever you're referring it to, and that will be fine by me.
Great. Those are some great pointers. Thank you.
All right. So moving across to chronic limb-threatening ischemia, because I agree that this one is a little bit contentious about how urgent it is. It's certainly not a 3 o'clock in the morning phone call, but is it a 6 o'clock in the evening phone call? And chronic, it just means that it's been there for longer than 2 weeks. Limb-threatening, because the risk of losing the limb once someone's moved into chronic limb-threatening ischemia territory. And by that, rest pain or tissue loss, so any kind of ulceration or non-healing cuts, is really high. So I'm going to go a bit, this is almost the same case. So this 85-year-old bloke comes into the emergency department, is acutely pale, pulseless, painful leg. His GCS is 15 out of 15. He's maintaining his airway and his blood pressure is a bit high. He's in sinus rhythm. He's a current smoker and he lives independently. But for 1 year, every time he goes for a walk, after about 2 minutes, he starts getting pain, which gets better when he rests. And it's different. It's the same presentation, but it's a different history. And it goes back to being that it's a ruptured plaque. It's that true heart attack of the leg. This is a very old slide, but it talks about the death of the artery and this very gradual deterioration from this beautiful, pristine intima to intimal injury for whatever reason, hypertension, smoking, and your dyslipidemia, which can irritate the intima, but also increases your risk of drawing all those lipids in and getting your macrophages all excitable and gradually blocking off the artery. And the problem with only seeing it at a very late stage is by the time someone moves into rest pain or tissue loss, they've often got multi-level disease. And we truly believe that if you've got tissue loss, the only way to heal it is to have inline flow. So if you've got someone who's a claudicant, so let's say the picture B, where they've got a complete SFA occlusion, at the moment we don't treat those routinely because there are risks to intervention. But if we did, it would be a pretty simple fix. Hopefully it would be endovascular. At the very end stage, if they had a nice vein, it might be a bypass if they were young. But by the time we get over to rest pain, ulcer and gangrene, we're looking at multi-level disease. And then it is often a hybrid procedure. So a mixture of keyhole, a long bypass, endarterectomies, and trying to put a bypass into those femdismals, femdistal bypasses onto these small, crural, diseased arteries down somewhere in the calf, sometimes in the foot, on the hope that we can save this leg. So the early triggers that, and at this stage, we might not be intervening on them with surgery, but we are going to be optimizing their risk factors and their medication to stop them going any further, is this classic pain, often in the calf, relieved by rest. There is no pain at rest. You can get it in the thighs or your buttocks if you've got common iliac disease, and you can have something called the Riche syndrome if you have thigh or buttock claudication. And you also have erectile dysfunction, and that's common iliac disease where both your external and your internal iliacs are affected. It's a recurrent pattern, and it's mainly a quality of life issue. And I say it's mainly a quality of life issue because half of those patients, if you just left them alone with supervised exercise and addressing their risk factors, half of them will improve and walk themselves out of ever needing intervention. About 30% of them are going to stay the same, irrelevant of what we do. About 20% have a chance of getting worse. So about 1 in 5 are going to get worse. But only 5% of those, so 5 out of 100 patients with an intermittent claudication, are ever going to truly require intervention. And I say this in the public sector, and only 1% will end up with a major amputation. The main issue with the claudicants is that 15% of them are going to be dead at 5 years of associated cardiovascular disease. So although we don't operate on them, what we will ask for and what we would offer in our clinics, and which the national guidelines for your high 5-year cardiovascular risk predicted score is, would be an antiplatelets, an aspirin probably, and a statin as tolerated. So the dream is atorvastatin 80 milligrams, but there are a variety of other things. There's a lot of issues around statins still. So honestly, whatever can be tolerated. So we have, for these, we have particularly good evidence. Now, the Capri study looked at clopidogrel or aspirin, and clopidogrel had a slightly favorable profile only for those with peripheral arterial disease, so not those who'd had a stroke or an aortic aneurysm. So sometimes in claudicants, we do move to cloppy, but the differences are across a huge population. But controlling hypertension is huge for reducing the risk of intimal damage and deterioration in your arterial disease. And then the heart protection study was a huge study. It did just use atorvastatin 80 milligrams, but it demonstrated that the statin truly did improve your five-year cardiovascular mortality. We've got a few studies which say that in the perioperative period, it also improves survival, even if you're only taking it for up to 6 weeks before your major surgery. Glycemic control in your diabetics to reduce your microvascular complications in the long term. Exercise and then smoking is on there. I suppose smoking is pretty self-explanatory, but it doesn't just improve your cardiovascular risk. It improves your perioperative mortality from chest infections, from aspiration pneumonia. If you smoke, your rate of aneurysm size increase is much higher, but it's all about risk factor management. Because if we can avoid that 5% moving into true critical limb-threatening ischemia, then we can save a huge amount of life years. So if you move into critical limb-threatening ischemia, it doesn't matter what I do. I'm not curing anything. 50% of my patients will be dead within 5 years of associated cardiovascular disease. And that's not one study. This is data that's just borne out again and again. And when we look at our own figures as well, a quarter, despite our best efforts, will still have a major amputation. And we're going to intervene on the majority of them. And this is a common, these are two common things. So these are patients who've moved, they're not got wet gangrene, which will be a clinical emergency. This is chronic dry gangrene. You see nice demarcation. It's true mummification, by which I mean it is dry. It doesn't make the patient sick. The dream is that you get really beautiful demarcation on the viable skin underneath. And eventually eventually it falls off in their sock, if they're lucky. And we do have options to treat. Often angioplasty. And there are a lot of trials that have helped us tease out or try to help us tease out whether we should use an angioplasty or just go straight for a bypass. And there are a few different factors that affect our decision. But an angioplasty is a joy because it's minimally invasive. Our radiologists do it and they're very good at it. I suppose in Australia, more surgeons do it. It can be done under local anaesthetic. So really good for our patients if they've got a lot of comorbidity, and a general anaesthetic is much higher risk. It can be repeated, although the Basel study suggested that it wasn't the free go that we thought it was. There is a small chance of making it worse, and it can make it worse because that balloon can crack and rupture that plaque and move what was a smooth, stable plaque into an acute hemorrhagic plaque with distal thrombosis. So throwing off that clot further down and turning it from a semi-stable leg into an acute emergency. And then the other options that we often use are a bypass. And that's as simple as identifying healthy artery above, healthy artery below, controlling the pipe, and then sewing in some kind of conduit, a graft above and below the blockage, from as healthy to as healthy an artery as you can manage. The great saphenous vein is our absolute fave. Unfortunately, it's the fave for our cardiothoracic surgeons as well, and there's quite a strong crossover in patients. But you do need a general anaesthetic for this. They are large incisions, same thing, it can make it worse. But this will be a common, and this doesn't even show the big incision up in the groin to get to the common femoral artery, but we are essentially flaying the leg open, both to get the full length of great saphenous vein, but also to create our tunnel and to get to the arteries above and below the blockage. So it's a big old day out for everybody involved, blood loss and things like that. So that's why, same thing, we try and get them early, but the implications for both claudication and critical limb-threatening ischemia are really optimizing risk factors as well. The survival from critical limb-threatening ischemia is worse than the majority of cancers, with far less money or research.
Quite exciting, though, that, 50% if you do risk modification can sort of write themselves in a way. So you can avoid major surgery and ongoing illness or pain.
This is for the claudicants. Yeah. So this is if you're at the point of you only getting pain to walk. Exactly. So yep. In private, if you're a Claudicant, I mean, you could probably get whatever you want. And in the US, people will have intervention for much less, but 50% will get themselves out of trouble. The best, the truly best treatment that we have for Claudicants, if treatment's indicated, is an antiplatelet and a statin, is walking and angioplasty. And the combination of all those things is our absolutely optimum.
And when you say walking, is there sort of a guideline around how much? And
yeah, so there's lots of talk in the UK about supervised exercise programs because that's the gold standard. And what we mean by that, or if we're talking to people about a walking program, we're talking about 20 to 30 minutes of walking at least 3 to 4 times a week. And that's walking where you walk to your point of claudication. And if you have to stop, you stop and you rest and the pain goes and then you start up again. And there are some supervised exercise programs. They have excellent outcomes. The problem with them is that they cost money and the patients are often self-selecting because you've got to have, the patients have got to be able to afford at a very basic level. They've got to have a program that's local enough. They have to be able to afford to get to the program. So it is, you get good outcomes and because it's self-selecting. Ah, does exercise help by promoting collateral flow? I'm laughing at this because this came up in my NRCS exam with a guy called Ian Chetter. And that's what we think, but it's not, we don't think it's by competitive flow, but it's probably on aspect of nitrous oxide or free radical production. And then something to do with how the free radicals impact your nitrous production within the muscles of the leg. And this is well beyond my ken. My interest isn't in this. But so it's about neovascularization. Collaterals are often, you know, existing blood vessels. So we have our named blood vessels, and then there are hundreds of blood vessels in the leg that we just don't name. They're too small. So it's about recruiting those and also neovascularization, but also muscle tolerance to the hypoxia as well. And then someone was asking about doing a bypass distal to the ankle. Yes, we can do a bypass onto the dorsalis pedis into the foot. You know, we'll have a go at most things. And we can do a bypass onto the plantar arches of the posterior tibial. So the posterior tibial runs behind your medial malleolus and then it splits off. And we can do a bypass onto one of those two branches just beyond it with varying success. But we like giving it a shot. What's the worst that can happen?
Well, okay. If you don't, you might lose your leg.
I know. I'm shrugging, but because, you know, if somebody needs a bypass down to their dorsalis pedis, then they're in real bad news, kind of last ditch territory. Mm. And it very much depends on the psychology of the patient, you know, what they're willing to take, what anesthetically we think that they can manage, and truly what we're trying to get back to. So if we've got somebody who is a carer for a family member and really relies on their leg, then we'd probably bash our heads against the wall with them in a much more stubborn way compared to someone who's actually probably got a very good chance of getting onto a below knee prosthesis and would have a very good quality of life. So there are some patients where we would offer major amputation much earlier than others, because if you leave someone with critical limb-threatening ischemia and chronic pain for 3-4 months, they become so deconditioned, their chance of recovery is much lower. Whereas if you think that they will do very well with a primary amputation, it can be better to offer them a primary amputation much earlier on in their journey before they have lost the weight, become sarcopenic or malnourished, cardiovascularly, completely deconditioned by lack of activity. And that's where the MDT comes in, and family, you know, FANO members and all of those things.
So how do we determine who we refer to your outpatient clinics? Like, obviously, you know, we could potentially manage some of these, and I'm speaking a wee bit from my general practice perspective, in our clinics and do the risk factor modification. But when would you want to hear about them? Like anyone who's a Claudicant? Or how do we determine what, is there a set sort of so many meters, so many minutes that they can walk before they get, I don't know, is there some sort of way? It's probably in Health Pathways somewhere. I mean, I live on Health Pathways. It's an amazing system.
Some of it is, you know, we were talking about local solutions to local problems, and there are, it does depend on the resources in your local region. So for example, we used to have a claudication clinic run by FEE, our specialist vascular nurse, just for these sorts of patients that we weren't going to intervene on because their walking distance was 200 meters. And to bring them all in so they could all meet each other and talk through the basics and why they're not getting intervention and the importance of best medical therapy. But as our patient numbers have increased and her workload has increased, we just don't have that capacity anymore. I think the short answer is that if you don't mind what is hopefully, and I would expect to be a polite decline of a referral with hopefully helpful things saying at the moment we don't have capacity to manage these patients, then you refer as many as you need or want to. And gradually you get a feel for what your local service can provide.
Yep.
Anybody with an acute change, so anybody who's less than 50 meters is a broad rule of thumb, but anybody who's changed from being 500 meters to suddenly dropping down to 20 meters or 30 meters, that's that semi-acute limb ischemia, that's that ruptured plaque. So anybody with an acute change is probably always warrants a referral.
Thank you.
All right, on to something slightly more cheerful. So this is a final one. So a 30-year-old woman comes in complaining of left lower leg swelling and pain for 2 days. She had an uncomplicated cesarean section 1 month earlier. Lovely baby, all very healthy. And on physical examination, she had edema and redness all the way from the groin down the left lower leg. And in addition to that, she was very sore in her calf muscle. So again, what you're looking at is a left leg that is different to the right. And, you know, you have to trust me when I say the right leg is normal, but it is swollen throughout. She's got discoloration of the leg throughout. And she's telling you she's got tenderness. Her D-dimer is 2,690. And these are my local values. Yours might differ slightly. And her fibrinogen is a little high as well. And I suppose the question for people outside of a hospital setting is whether or not your management would differ if she came to see you at 11:30 in the morning or if she saw you at 9 p.m. at night. And I think that's probably the case because you're looking at the WELL score and a D-dimer. And I think on Health Pathways, the barrier to requesting a D-dimer for the WELL score is going to change. And you're also looking at risk factors to see whether or not you think they might have a deep vein thrombosis. And unless they are at risk of bleeding for whatever reason that might be, a treatment dose Clexane, or in some cases you might immediately start them on a DOAC, and you please put them in class 2 compression. We used to get some pushback because the concern was that the class 2 compression might squeeze the thrombus up into the pulmonary circulation. And I don't know if that was taught, but it is incorrect. And what is so important about the class 2 stockings is that it helps with swelling. And if the swelling continues to get worse, you will eventually end up with venous compartment syndrome. So the class 2 compression is vital to bringing the swelling down. It improves the pain in the leg. And it does also, in this case, recruit collateral. So it gets blood pumping off the veins that are still open around the thrombosed ones. And you're going to get a duplex as soon as possible. So if it's at nighttime, your local pathway will be what you follow, but often it's a dose of treatment dose Clexane and then booking in for an urgent ultrasound scan within the next 24 to 48 hours. And it's going to confirm your diagnosis. If, and we're changing Health Pathways at the moment again to move from it saying severe DVT, if the clot extends up to the common femoral vein, that means that it's probably obstructing drainage, not just from your deep veins, but also from your great saphenous vein. And that is much worse because then the whole named main drainage from your leg is blocked. There will be collaterals there. So if the thrombus moves up to the level of the inguinal ligament or above and they can't see where it stops, that is an indication for referral to your hospital for a CT venogram. And you're going to want to do that both to confirm the extent and where it goes up to, and also to identify if there is an obstruction. So in the case of a young lady post-section, you'd hope there wasn't. On the left, we might also see a May Turner's, which exacerbates this alongside our other risk factors. But in older patients who present with large DVTs, what we're really looking for is a primary malignancy. In this case, the ultrasound showed thrombus in the profunda vein and the superficial femoral vein, and it was reaching the common femoral vein and it was extending above the ligament. And because she'd had a recent section, they couldn't see where the clot stopped. She was diagnosed with a postpartum deep vein thrombosis. We knew that it was left iliofemoral DVT, and she had a CT venogram, which confirmed that it was extending into the IVC. And this is the kind of thing that we often see. So this is a CT venogram phase. On that picture in the top left, you've got the draining, the renal vein on the right. That's the right kidney under the liver. Nice and draining. And she has got clot extending all the way up to the level of that draining renal vein, which is very common because there'll be stasis in the IVC all the way up to the level of the draining vein, and the left renal vein will be a little higher than that. And then you've got a couple of axial planes as well. In that bottom right-hand picture, there's this little tongue of clot extending up into that IVC. And those are the ones that we really worry about getting pulmonary emboli. Chances are, even if they're asymptomatic, on their CT venogram, we will probably spot some PEs. And that picture at the top is why compression is so important, because the very, very severe end, you are at risk of cerulea dolens. So where the compartment pressures in the calf are so high that you get venous stasis, which stops venous drainage, which increases the pressure even more. And eventually the pressures are so high that you get arterial stasis and arterial occlusion, even from a deep vein thrombosis. And then you're at risk of limb loss. It's very rare. I've only seen it once. Fasciotomies fixed the problem. But about a quarter of them will extend above the inguinal ligament, increased risk of PE, so recognition is important. And the thing that we've moved to recognizing a little more in the chronic setting is that if you've got clot going into your iliac vein and blocking all of that drainage off, you've got a much higher risk of post-thrombotic syndrome, where you move over the next 5 years into a leg which is chronically swollen, chronic venous stasis, chronic ulceration, venous claudication, absolute misery. And one of the reasons that I'm working with the guys to change health pathways at the moment is because we have much newer technology available. The traditional intervention for these clots is lysis, but catheter directed lysis. So in through the groin or perhaps down at the knee, passing a long, thin perforated catheter into the clots at one point, because often you can't cover the whole clot, and then putting them on an infusion of alteplase or whatever it is that you use in your center for 24 hours or 12 hours. And the historical studies have your absolute contraindications and your relative contraindications as to when it's too dangerous to use because your risk of bleeding is too high. And even in young, healthy patients, we often quote a cerebral bleed risk of between 1% and 4%. Nowadays, that's probably no longer true, but it plays on your mind because the thought of giving somebody thrombolysis in a clot, which is not putting their limb or life at risk, because I could anticoagulate them with heparin to reduce their risk of the clot getting worse and them getting more PEs. So we now have newer technologies that don't use lysis. And the one on the far left has been a bit of a game changer. It's called Clot Retriever, and it's like doing an embolectomy but in the veins. It's a basket, you pass a collapsed basket through the clot, open up the basket, and you draw all of that clot out, and you give them some heparin, you make their blood thin, but in a controllable fashion. And that's probably been a bit of a game changer. So we are changing health pathways so that patients who we think are probably at higher risk of developing post-thrombotic syndrome at 5-10 years time, which are, you know, I'll still be around and I'll be seeing them, we can try and remove that or really improve their clot burden without having to use lysis. Older patients who traditionally weren't for lysis because of their age, she had a C-section a month ago. Because we're not giving lysis and we're giving heparin, which I can reverse acutely and on the table, I can do it in somebody who's just had surgery as well. And then different centres will use different things with lower lysis things. So the main thing to say is that there is a list of patients that we thought we couldn't actively treat with a deep vein thrombosis because of the lysis risk. And now we have technology that means that's no longer the case. So that was a wee case-based whiz. I hope that was helpful.
Very. Thank you very much, Ruth. Really appreciate your time. That was really fascinating. There was so much great stuff in there. I look forward to trying to feel the popliteal pulse on my patients going forward. And really appreciate everyone coming this evening. There'll be a little hiatus of webinars until October or November. So I'll look forward to catching up with you then. Thank you. And also thank you very much, David, for joining us this evening and being part of the team. Really appreciate it.